The amiable purser came walking through, ever attentive to his passengers' comfort. The efficient cabin crew came round with breakfast. There is no nation like the Swiss for efficiency in the air, for attending to the passengers' wants, and for providing truly excellent food. The cats sat up and were all attention at the thought of eating again. Far off to the right a hazy grey line appeared and rapidly grew larger. New York. Inevitably I thought of the first time I had come to America, working my way as a ship's engineer. Then the skyscrapers of Manhattan had towered heavenwards, impressing with their size. Now, where were they? Not those little dots, surely? The great plane circled, and a wing dipped. The engines changed their pitch. Gradually we sank lower and lower. Gradually buildings on the ground took shape. What had appeared to be a desolate waste resolved itself into idle Old International Airport. The skilled Swiss pilot set the plane down with just a faint scrunch of tires. Gently we taxied along the runway to the airport buildings. "Keep your seats, please," said the purser. A gentle thud as the mobile stairway came to rest against the fuselage, a metallic scraping, and the cabin door was swung open. "Goodbye," said the cabin crew, lining the exit, "travel with us again." Slowly we filed down the stairway and into the administrative buildings. Idlewild was like a railway station gone mad. People rushed everywhere, jostling any that stood in their path. An attendant stepped forward, "This way, customs clearance first." We were lined up by the side of moving platforms. Great masses of luggage suddenly appeared, moving along the platforms, stretching from the entrance to the customs man. The officials walked along, rummaging through open cases. "Where you from, folks?" said an officer to me. "Dublin, Ireland," I replied. "Where you going?" "Windsor, Canada," I said. "Okay, got any pornographic pictures?" he asked suddenly. With him settled, we had to show passports and visas. It reminded me of a Chicago meat packing factory. The way people were processed. Before we left Ireland we had booked seats on an American plane to fly us to Detroit. They agreed to take the cats in the plane with us. Now the officials of the airline concerned repudiated our tickets, and refused to take our two cats who had crossed the Atlantic without trouble or fuss. For a time it seemed that we were stuck in New York. The airline was not remotely interested. I saw an advertisement for air taxis to anywhere from LaGuardia Airfield. Taking an airport limousine, we went the several miles to a motel just outside LaGuardia. "Can we bring in our cats?" we asked the man at the registration desk. He looked at them, two demure little ladies, and said, "Sure, sure, they're welcome." The Lady Grey and Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers were glad indeed to have a chance to walk about and investigate two more rooms. The strain of the journey was now telling upon me. I retired to bed. My wife crossed the road to LaGuardia, trying to find what an air taxi would cost, and when we could be taken. Eventually she returned looking worried. "It is going to cost a lot of money," she said. "Well, we cannot stay here, we have to move," I replied. She picked up the telephone and soon arranged that on the morrow we would fly by air taxi to Canada. We slept well that night. The cats were quite unconcerned, it even seemed that they were enjoying themselves. In the morning, after breakfast, we were driven across the road to the airport. LaGuardia is immense, with a plane taking off or landing every minute of the day. At last we found the place from whence we were to go, and we, our cats, and our luggage were loaded aboard a small twin-engined plane. The pilot, a little man with a completely shaven head, nodded curtly to us. And off we taxied to a runway. For some 2 miles we taxied and then pulled into a bay to wait our turn to take off. The pilot of a big intercontinental plane waved to us, and spoke hurriedly into his microphone. Our pilot uttered some words which I cannot repeat, and said, "We have a puncture." The air was rent by a screaming police siren. A police cruiser raced madly along a service road and pulled up alongside us with a mad squeal of tires. "Police? What have we done now?" I asked myself. More sirens, and the fire brigade arrived, men spilling off as the machine slowed. The policeman came across and spoke to our pilot. They moved away to the fire engine, and at last the police and firemen moved off. A repair car raced along, jacked up the plane in which we were sitting, removed the offending wheel, and raced off. For 2 hours we sat there waiting for the wheel to be returned to us. At last the wheel was on, the pilot started his engines again, and we took off. Off we flew, over the Allegheny Range, headed first for Pittsburgh. Right over the mountains the fuel gauge, right in front of me, dropped to zero and started knocking against the stop. The pilot seemed blandly unaware of it. I pointed it out and he said, in a whisper, "Ah, sure, we can always go down." Minutes after we came to a level space in the mountains, a space where many light planes were parked. The pilot circled once, and landed, taxiing along to the petrol pumps. We stopped just long enough to have the plane refueled, and then off again from the snow-covered, frozen runway. Deep banks of snow lined the sides, great drifts were in the valleys. A short flight, and we were over Pittsburgh. We were sick of traveling, stiff and weary. Only the Lady Kue was alert. She sat and looked out of a window and appeared pleased with everything. With Cleveland beneath us, we saw Lake Erie right in front. Great masses of ice were piled up, while fantastic cracks and fissures ran across the frozen lake. The pilot, taking no risks, made course for Pelly Island, halfway across the lake. From there he flew on to Amherstburg, and on to Windsor Airport. The airport looked strangely quiet. There was no bustle of activity. We moved up to the customs building, alighted from the plane, and went inside. A solitary customs man was just going off duty. It was after 6 at night. Gloomily he contemplated our baggage. "There is no immigration officer here," he said. "You will have to wait until one comes." We sat and waited. The slow minutes crawled by. Half an hour, time itself seemed to stand still. We had had no food or drink since 8 o'clock that morning. The clock struck 7. A relief customs man came in and dawdled about. "I can't do a thing until the immigration officer has cleared you," he said. Time seemed to be going more slowly. 7:30. A tall man came in and went to the immigration officer's office. Looking frustrated and a little red in the face, he came out to the customs man. "I can't get the desk open," he said. For a time they muttered together, trying keys, banging, pushing. At last, in desperation, they took a screwdriver and forced the desk lock. It was the wrong desk, it was quite empty. Eventually the forms were found. Wearily we filled them in, signing here, signing there. The immigration officer stamped our passports, landed immigrant. "Now you go to the customs officer," he said. "Cases to open. Boxes to unlock. Forms to show, giving details of our belongings as settlers, more rubber stamps," and at last we were free to enter Canada at Windsor, Ontario. The customs officer warmed up considerably when he knew we came from Ireland. Of Irish descent himself, with his Irish parents still living. He asked many questions and, wonder of wonders, he helped carry our luggage to the waiting car. Outside the airport it was bitter. The snow was thick upon the ground. Just across the Detroit River the skyscrapers towered aloft, a mass of light as all the offices and rooms were illuminated, for Christmas was at hand. We drove down the wide Ouellette Avenue, the main street of Windsor. The river was invisible, and it looked as if we were going to drive straight to America. The fellow who was driving us did not seem at all sure of his directions, missing a main intersection. He made a remarkable maneuver which made our hair stand on end. Eventually we reached our rented house and were glad indeed to alight. Very soon I had a communication from the Board of Health demanding my presence, threatening terrible things, including deportation, if I did not attend. Unfortunately, threats seem to be the main hobby of the Ontario officials. That is why we are now going to move again, to a more friendly province. At the Board of Health I was X-rayed. More details were taken, and at last I was allowed to go home again. Windsor has a terrible climate, and that and the attitude of officials soon decided us to move as soon as this book is written. Now the Ramper story is finished. The truth has been told, as in my other 2 books. I have much that I could tell the Western world, for in astral traveling I have touched merely upon the fringe of things which are possible. Why send out spy planes with its attendant risks when one can travel in the astral and see inside a council chamber? One can see and one can remember. Under certain circumstances one can teleport articles, if it be wholly for good. But Western man scoffs at things he does not understand, yells faker to those who have abilities which he himself does not possess, and works himself into a frenzy of vituperation against those who dare to be in any way different. Happily I put aside my typewriter and settled down to entertain the Lady Grey and blind Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers, who both had waited so patiently. That night, telepathically, came the message again. Lobsang. You have not yet finished your book. My heart sank. I hated writing, knowing that so few people had the capacity to perceive truth. I write of the things which the human mind can accomplish. Even the elementary stages described in this book will be disbelieved, yet if one were to be told that the Russians had sent a man to Mars, that would be believed. Man is afraid of the powers of man's mind, and can contemplate only the worthless things like rockets and space satellites. Better results can be achieved through mental processes. Lobsang. Truth? Do you remember the Hebrew tale? Write it down, Lobsang. And write also of what could be, in Tibet. A rabbi, famed for his learning and his wit, was once asked why he so often illustrated a great truth by telling a simple story. That, said the wise rabbi, can best be illustrated by a parable. A parable about parable. There was a time when truth went among people unadorned, as naked as truth. Whoever saw truth turned away in fear or in shame because they could not face him. Truth wandered among the peoples of the earth, unwelcome, rebuffed, and unwanted. One day, friendless and alone, he met Parable strolling happily along, dressed in fine and many-colored clothes. Truth, why are you so sad, so miserable? Asked Parable, with a cheerful smile. Because I am so old and so ugly that people avoid me, said Truth, early. Nonsense. Laughed Parable. That is not why people avoid you. Borrow some of my clothes, go among people and see what happens. So Truth donned some of Parable's lovely garments, and wherever he now went he was welcome. The wise old rabbi smiled and said, men cannot face naked truth, they much prefer him disguised in the clothing of Parable. Yes, yes, Lobsang, that is a good translation of our thoughts. Now the tale. The cats wandered off to sit on their beds and wait until I really had finished. I picked up the typewriter again, inserted the paper, and continued. From afar the watcher sped, gleaming a ghostly blue as he flashed over continents and oceans, leaving the sunlit side of the earth for the dark. In his astral state he could be seen only to those who were clairvoyant, yet he could see all and, returning later to his body, remember all. He dropped, immune to cold, untroubled by thinness of air, to the shelter of a high peak, and waited. The first rays of the morning sun glinted briefly on the highest pinnacles of rock, turning them to gold, reflecting a myriad of colors from the snow in the crevices. Vague streaks of light shot across the lightning sky as slowly the sun peeped across the distant horizon. Down in the valley strange things were happening. Carefully shielded lights moved about, as if on trailers. The silver thread of the happy river gleamed faintly, throwing back flecks of light. There was much activity, strange, concealed activity. The lawful inhabitants of Lhasa hid in their homes, or lay under guard in their forced labor barracks. Gradually the sun moved upon its path. Soon the first rays, probing downwards, glinted upon a strange shape that loomed up far across the valley floor. As the sunlight grew brighter, the watcher saw the immense shape more clearly. It was huge, cylindrical, and on its pointed end, facing the heavens above, were painted eyes and a toothed and snagged mouth. For centuries the Chinese seamen had painted eyes upon their ships. Now, upon this monster the eyes glared hate. The sun moved on. Soon the whole valley was bathed in light. Strange metal structures were being towed away from the monster, now only partly enshrouded in its cradle. The immense rocket, towering on its fins, looked sinister, deadly. At its base technicians with headphones on were running about like a colony of disturbed ants. A siren sounded shrilly, and the echoes rebounded, from rock to rock, from mountain wall to mountain wall, blending into a fearful, horrendous cacophony of sound which built up, becoming louder and louder. Soldiers, guards, laborers, turned on the instant and ran as fast as they could to the shelter of the distant rocks. Halfway up the mountainside, the light glinted on a little group of men clustered around radio equipment. A man picked up a microphone and spoke to the inhabitants of a great concrete and steel shelter lying half concealed about a mile from the rocket. A droning voice counted out the seconds and then stopped. For scant moments nothing happened, there was peace. The lazy tendrils of vapor seeping from the rocket were the only things that moved. A gush of steam, and a roaring that grew louder and louder, starting small rock falls. The earth itself seemed to vibrate and groan. The sound became louder and louder until it seemed that the eardrums must shatter under such intensity. A great gout of flame and steam appeared from the base of the rocket, obscuring all below. Slowly, as if with immense, with stupendous effort, the rocket rose. At one time it seemed to be standing stationary on its tail of fire, then it gathered speed and climbed up into the quaking heavens, booming and roaring defiance to mankind. Up, up it went, leaving a long train of steam and smoke. The scream vibrated among the mountaintops long after all sight of it had gone. The group of technicians on the mountainside feverishly watched their radarscopes, yammered into their microphones, or scanned the skies with high-powered binoculars. Far, far overhead a vagrant gleam of light flashed down as the mighty rocket turned and settled on its course. Scared faces appeared from behind rocks. Little groups of people congregated, with all distinction between guards and slave laborers temporarily forgotten. The minutes ticked on. Technicians switched off their radar sets, for the rocket had soared far beyond their range. The minutes ticked on. Suddenly the technicians leapt to their feet, gesticulating madly, forgetting to switch on the microphones in their excitement. The rocket, with an atomic warhead, had landed in a far distant, peace-loving country. The land was a shambles, with cities wrecked, and people vaporized to incandescent gas. The Chinese communists, with the loudspeakers full on, screamed and shouted with glee, forgetting all reserve in the joy of their dreadful accomplishment. The first stage of war had ended, the second was about to start. Exulting technicians rushed to make the second rocket ready. Is it fantasy? It could be fact. The higher the launching point of a rocket, the less the atmosphere impedes it, and so it takes far, far less fuel. A rocket launched from the flat lands of Tibet, 17,000 feet above sea level, would be more efficient than one launched from the lowlands. So the communists have an incalculable advantage over the rest of the world. They have the highest and most efficient sites from which to launch rockets either into space or at other countries. China has attacked Tibet, not conquered it, so that she shall have this great advantage over Western powers. China has attacked Tibet so that she shall have access to India, when she is ready, and perhaps drive on through India to Europe. It could be that China and Russia will combine to make a pincer thrust which could crush out the free life of all countries that stood in their way. It could be, unless something is done soon, Poland? Pearl Harbor? Tibet? Experts would have said that such enormities could not be. They were wrong. Are they going to be wrong again?